This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly New Year's Eve special. Jules Holland joins us to look back on Manchester United 3, Burnley 1. Not entirely convincing, but McTominay's worked out that side foot from 20 yards and Cavani's movements remain as regular as ever. Is interim consultant caretaker Ranić working things out? Burnley look too good to go down, so does that mean it's inevitable? Also, Romelu Lukaku says he's a grafter, but he's not happy. Is that okay? Because he did it in another language, so no one will notice. We've got a big EFL chat with Car Park's Ben Fisher. Bournemouth have picked up after their little blip, while Blackburn are flying, hunting down Fulham. Stuart Ripley and Jason Wilcox putting it on a plate for Ben Brereton Diaz right now. Which manager bounces the highest, Chris Wilder or Steve Cooper? And Dock Points Derby, 3 wins on the bounce. Could they survive? All that plus idle speculation in the transfer window, who needs what section? Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Ed Aarons, welcome. Ed Aarons, welcome.
Thank you, Max. How are you?
Finally, after years of pronouncing your name correctly.
We got there.
I had a chance to get it right first time, and I messed it up. Neda Manua, is that right?
Yeah, I'll take that. You know,
okay. What would your dream be?
My dream. Neda Manuaha, but let's not force it. Let's just keep it simple.
With the H, Neda Manuaha.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but you know, it doesn't matter. Does it? Okay. It's just my name.
No. I think it's important. Right. I've worked my way up to this. Ben Fisher, welcome.
Hi, Max. How's it going?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Lots of questions in the AOB section for you, Ben. Have you got any grade A anecdotes to bring us?
I don't know, but just honoured to be the subject of such interest.
Yeah, okay. Well, you've got to listen. The interest will only remain if you can keep up the quality of the anecdotes, Ben. That's the pressure that you have as part three comes to a close. Let's start at Old Trafford then. Man United 3, Burnley 1. Ralph Ranić's unbeaten start continues. But Nedim, it's not convincing, is it?
No, it's not convincing at all. I think that's why we've had so much talk about them and the possibility of how this season will go. Because he's obviously trying to bring in his new system, and he said there's been a few complaints in terms of players missing because of COVID and things like this. But you're not really seeing anything which makes you think that they're definitely going to finish fourth, or they're definitely going to go on a run in the FA Cup, or they're definitely going to do something in the Champions League. And maybe it's a case of it's a work in progress. But as you alluded to in the intro, the sort of caretaker, consultant, whatever position doesn't really afford you time to be able to be on the field for years at a time to get the best out of that formation, the best out of those players. So at the end of the day, I suppose they've won, but then how much can you really get excited about winning against a team that's in the bottom three? Obviously, the Newcastle debacle, as some people would say, wasn't great, but they've got 3 points on the board and they need them, because you're looking at Spurs, looking at Arsenal, even West Ham could have a bit of an uptick now. And there's real competition to get in fourth, which kind of blows my mind based on how the season started for them, to be honest.
So like when you were playing, and you know that cliche, like if you win when you're not playing that well, it's a sign of a really good team. Do the players know, actually, I don't know if we're good, we're just winning, but we probably shouldn't have?
I think it depends on how good you are as a team and what your expectations are. Because if you do play well at some point, then you'd be excited. But when was the last time United played so well that everyone was like, this is really impressive? You know, I think the fact that they didn't play that well and they won against Burnley is good. But then if they were doing the same thing against Liverpool, because I think it was Paul Scholes said it, they played against Atalanta in the Champions League and they didn't play that well, but they won the game. And he said, I'm alarmed because Liverpool are going to be coming here on the weekend. And if they play anything like this, then it's going to be bad news. And then next thing, they lost 5-0. So there is more to it than essentially just basically just getting the results. But I don't know. I think Ranić was supposed to be in there to bring in, to have that new manager balance, see something a bit more exciting, all that stuff. But it doesn't feel like we're seeing it at the moment. But thankfully for him, he's still got another 18, 19 games to go.
Ed, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I think there are signs of some progress, even if it's, you know, not that much, at least in results anyway. You know, he has had a bit of a bounce in terms of, you know, being unbeaten, and there has been an improvement. But I think somebody like that needs quite a while to implement his methods, and I think you could see it from, you know, it, almost before he got the job, you know, the fact that he has got this clause about him being a consultant after he leaves his post, whatever happens. I think he, you know, he sees an opportunity here, not only for himself but for the club, you know, from his point of view, to try and implement his style that he did, you know, in Austria and Germany so successfully with Red Bull, you know, and that sort of thing is going to take not just time but also different personnel, I think. You know, I think this month could be quite interesting to see whether he goes into the market, what kind of player he brings in. I imagine some sort of young profile players are going to be high on the agenda for United, because somebody, you know, players that can be moulded into what they want, you know, in the future. And somebody like Ranieri, I think maybe even a year and a half isn't going to be enough. You know, perhaps if they're really serious about it, they might be thinking of extending his contract even further, perhaps. Or, you know, the plan is supposed to be that another manager comes in who can continue what he's doing. So I don't know whether they're going to stick to that or not, but in the short term anyway, he's having a slight impact. But yeah, we'll have to see whether that really translates into the games against the bigger sides.
I think that's interesting, Ed, because I think that's feels like it's a long-term thing. But if somebody's going to be a caretaker manager for another 6 months, that's distinctly short-term in the grand scheme of football. And if he's bringing somebody else in, which manager wants to come in and basically be told what to do by somebody else? It's like it's like a really weird situation. Even, say, if they want to sign players as of next week, as he goes to the boardroom, is he going as the consultant? Is he going as the caretaker manager that's done in 6 months? So, like, I don't know. It's so interesting.
I thought this was the first sensible thing that United had done almost since Fergie.
In what sense, though?
Well, I don't know, because Ralf Rangnick knows football.
Yeah, I mean, it's sensible to an extent, but I think would have been, perhaps even now, almost getting to the stage already where you should say, you know, give him another year, perhaps. Unless there's somebody yeah. who's lined up, because it's not the same. I know that's exactly the same as happened with Solskjaer, and he got the job permanently, didn't he, rather than for another year after being the interim. But yeah, like I said, somebody like Ranieri, it's so short term, you know, blink and it'll be over soon enough. So
yeah, and with the way the season's gone now, it feels like there could be two extremes here. United could maybe win the FA Cup, they could do well in the Champions League, they could finish fourth, or they could go out in the FA Cup really, go out in the Champions League and finish seventh. If you are in charge of the team that finishes seventh and you're supposed to be there long term as a consultant, what do they want to consult you about? You know what I mean? Like, it feels like it's really obvious what their needs are this year. And if he doesn't reach them, then surely that means that he's failed in one element, which as a consequence must be a stain on the second bit, which he's supposed to be doing. But I don't know. I think they'll have a balance, because it just feels like they're Man United. They've got good players, so they'll figure it out. But it doesn't seem as cohesive as, say, other teams' plans at this moment in time, which is probably why they are where they are.
Meanwhile, Ben, Edison Cavani, his movement is good. Let me be the first to announce to the footballing world that Edison Cavani's movement is good.
It's weird, because him and Ronaldo, obviously, are these elite players, but they're so different. In Cavani, the threat, like you say, the movement, the kind of stealth nature of him, and the kind of, I don't know, aerially as well, that the threat he poses, I think, is a massive problem for defences. I remember that Southampton game where they turned it around. Was it last season? Maybe even the season before, I can't remember. But he was just, you know, he's a game changer. Little death finishes. Yeah, I love him. I'm so pleased to see him back involved. And it's interesting to see them obviously paired as a two up there. I don't know if that's a long-term thing, given their ages. But yeah, great to see Cavani back on the pitch.
I imagine he's really silent when he plays. I mean, obviously I have no idea, but have you ever played against him, Adam?
I haven't, no, but I've played against people like him. And I think the best way to describe it from a defensive standpoint, because you're seeing it from the positive in terms of his movement, but from a defensive standpoint, it's just really annoying. Somebody that you can't really just like get hold of and just say, stay here. You know, I'm trying to control you, just stay here. Like he's just relentless. And that's a great thing for his team. And he always make you that type of player. They make you almost stay incredibly honest, because I think sometimes with other strikers who tend to score goals, their movement tends to kick in only at certain points. But for him, it's just all the time. So you're always having to check and be communicating with the people at the back, because some players I've played against, like they'll do nothing. They'll literally do nothing for 80 minutes, nothing whatsoever. Not even be coming short, going long, just do nothing. but then they score and it's almost like, here we go, there it is, the inevitable. But for him, he's got the ability to score and to just get on your nerves for 90 minutes straight as you constantly try and figure out, is he to my left or to my right? And as you look left, he goes to your right. Some of these people, they're an absolute nightmare, to be honest.
Scott McTominay had a decent game, didn't he? And he had sort of three brilliant strikes, one that was saved and it led to Ronaldo's goal, and one that went in. He said after the game, Ed, body language is one thing, and the manager has come in and said he wants to cut that out, so that is final. We have taken it on board. I mean, presumably there's some body language is good, right? It's just like all total, like you're not allowed to show any emotion of any way.
Presumably he was speaking about negative body language, which is, I can understand that, actually. It's quite an interesting approach, isn't it, from Rangnick, whether it's, how you appear to others from the outside, and especially when, Man United, so many fans, so much spotlight on them. I think it's quite important to have that positive mindset, even if you're not feeling that confidence so much underneath it, or even if, sometimes you have to show it on the outside to be able to perform to your best. I think so. I think it is quite important, because if you're a shell of, in terms of confidence, and you've suffered in a previous game, then an opponent can easily get on top of you. You sense that, don't you? I'm sure that Nedham would agree with that. You sense if someone's not on their game, they're not feeling fully confident. So I think, United showing a bit of pride and that sort of thing is going to get the supporters on side as well. So it's kind of quite a good ploy, I think, for them. And just to mention along those lines, Jadon Sancho, he's really, since Rangnick's come in, he's kind of got that. You can see the difference in him, I think. Just, he's got a bit more self-belief. It's, the old Jadon Sancho's back. He's running with the ball a bit more, attacking players, scoring, creating goals, and finally looking like the player that everybody thought he was when they signed him.
Yeah, and I think for people who watch the Premier League and don't really watch the Bundesliga, desperate to see the brilliant Jadon Sancho. That'd be a wonderful thing when he's playing brilliantly. Ben, do you think United will get fourth?
I don't know. I don't know if I do. I don't know if I honestly... I thought they were just so poor, obviously, against Newcastle. Not convinced at the moment. I think the way that system, the 4-2-2-2, which people seem to now be respected a bit more now, Rangnick's doing it at United, whereas it Southampton with Hasenhüttl, everybody sort of just dumbs it down to a 4-4-2. I feel like, you need the fullbacks to be really expressive, really positive, which I think, to be fair, Southampton is how they've, when they're good, they're really effective with it. Don't know about Wan-Bissaka in that kind of role there, if that works. But like Ed said, maybe the profile of player will change over time. Obviously, there's quite a few older heads in there.
Do you know what? My favourite moment of the game was when Wan-Bissaka actually did really well and managed to get the ball and turn back, and he was just going to lay it back to David De Gea and then just punted it out for a corner on his left foot. It just made me feel good about my...
he definitely learned that at Palace, I think.
Yeah, you're probably right.
On the topic of body language, I know McTominay kind of took it to the other extreme, didn't he? Because when Ronaldo scored, he joined in with the chant from the crowd. I thought, that's ultra positive from Scott.
So what, he didn't jump with Ronaldo? He shouted it?
He shouted it and sort of embraced him. And
he did as well.
He smiles,
did,
yeah.
He did a mini jump as well. He landed exactly the same time, but he didn't do the arms thing. He just landed at the same time, and he was sort of, yeah.
Yeah, I just wonder how Ronaldo would feel if somebody, took any of his line. I mean, it would be nice if McTominay had done it for his first goal, really. I think that's what I want to see. Didn't someone... Who shithoused Ronaldo by doing...
Andros Townsend did it, didn't he?
It was Andros,
And then said it was a tribute.
Yeah. Aaron Lennon was running around like it was 2006, wasn't it? I'd sort of completely forgotten of his existence.
It took me back to extra time of that. Was it against Portugal in the quarterfinals? Oh.
Was that 06? Was that 06?
06, yeah. When he came off the bench and was a world beater.
In that World Cup, I wanted him to start ahead of Beckham. I was convinced, even though Beckham scored every goal or set up every goal, did everything, I just thought, it's Aaron Lennon's time. His first goal against United in his 23rd game against them, 18 years and 73 days since his first game against them in October 2003, for Leeds United when he was only 16. That's mad, isn't it?
That's mad.
He looks about the same age. It's like ridiculous. He always struck me as the best footballer, Nedim, that I'd ever seen who couldn't really kick it.
Beg your pardon? Kick it, in what sense?
I've never really seen him really kick the ball.
Like, you mean
I've never
far?
Seen him
far,
like, strike it. Like, just like, I've never really seen him strike a ball. Like, he just sort of, does that make any sense to anyone, not just you?
I think I understand what you're trying to say, but I think yeah. It goes to show that you can have a career without looking really good at just kicking the ball. He was always somebody who was like really hard to play against because his low center of gravity, his quick feet, all that stuff. And it was a nightmare. You know, the bigger you were, the harder it was going to be against him. But yeah, most of his time kicking the ball.
But could he kick it?
Most of the time, kicking the ball was like a sort of like a curved kick towards the box for somebody to head it in, usually like Peter Crouch and the like. But I know what you're saying. And to be honest, it was good to see him playing yesterday because I forgot that he was still there as well. But then it also reminded me, like, we're literally the same age. So as I'm 1 year retired, he's still running about Old Trafford. But fair play to him. Hope he enjoys that. And I just enjoyed watching it from my sofa.
See, I really loved the contrast of him not being able to get and next to occasionally playing with Tom Huddleston, who can kick a ball better than any human on earth with both feet. Just like, he'd just touch it and it would just go like a five iron. It was just, it was an absolute thrill to watch the pair of them there.
Tom was, Tom again is my age. So we played 21s together and the whole tactic was if you were playing defense, just get the ball and roll it to Tom. And then he's going to play a diagonal right or left footed and then just work out whatever needs to happen from there. He was simply delicious. What lovely stuff.
On the subject of not knowing where players were, Jim says, was anyone else as surprised to see Wayne Hennessy play for Burnley as Barry was to see Ramos at PSG? Yeah, so I was unaware that had passed me by as well. And, it was nice to see him.
He did a good save with his face, didn't he?
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah.
This is really
Burnley,
weird,
wasn't it?
Because that's another player that's my age. He was in my academy team. This is like my throwback. This is my throwback pod. Okay. Like, anyone else play who I know who have played the same age or what?
No, I mean, basically means... You retired. Why are you so lazy?
I can't even push back against that. I cannot push back against that. It was not for health reasons. It was purely just to enjoy Christmas this year. That's all it was. That's the only reason I gave up.
Or to get in the much more lucrative game of podcasts.
Yes. I didn't want to say it out loud, but yes, that's exactly right.
We're delighted. We're delighted to have you. Burnley, are they too good to go down, Ben?
No.
Okay.
But I think Sean Dyche, as ever, will take them close, and you know, wouldn't be surprised clearly if he does keep them up. The team does look, I know there's injuries, COVID and the rest of it, but does look, I was just looking a minute ago again, that does look just short of something. I mean, Dwight McNeil's a good player, obviously. Cornet has been in and out since, looking really good on those first couple of games. I think they'll keep hold of Tarkowski in January, obviously, with him out of contract at the end of the season. Can't see them allowing him to move on to a rival. You know, obviously, Newcastle have been linked. But I just wonder if they're... I don't know. I know Will Unwin did a piece for us a couple of weeks ago. I just wonder if time is running out for them. But then you wouldn't bet against Sean Dyche to be the one to find a way. I think Watford will go down. I think they'll get dragged in. It's all on Newcastle for me, to be honest. I think, you know, Norwich are gone. I think if Newcastle can do it, then Burnley could be in trouble.
George Mendes has been chatting about Ronaldo. I didn't realise there was any unrest around him, but he's claimed Ronaldo is very happy at Manchester United and he's going to continue with his solid, great performances as always in his career. It's going to be a great season for him, I'm sure, said George. Lee says, can you please talk about Lukaku? I just want to hear Max say it's extraordinary. I don't know if I will say it's extraordinary, but he was speaking to Sky Sports in Italy earlier this month and said, I'm not happy with the situation. That's only natural. The head coach has decided to play a different system and I mustn't let up. I need to keep working hard and be professional. I'm not happy with the situation, but I'm a grafter and I mustn't let up. I hope from the bottom of my heart that I can one day go back to Inter, not right at the end of my career, but when I'm still at a good level, so we can hopefully win more trophies. Ed, he's not necessarily saying he's hating everything and he wants to leave straight away, but it doesn't seem the most tactically astute thing to do.
No, but you have to, you know, I think you mentioned it did take place 3 weeks ago, the interview. But, you know, regardless of that, you probably shouldn't be saying that sort of thing. Because But the most interesting line for me was, you know, that he said that he decided to play a different tactic, which was quite telling, really, because back in when he said this, Lukaku was, yes, he was coming back from injury, but it took quite a while for him to get back in the team. Now he is. Now he's scoring a couple of goals. He's praised Tuchel. So maybe things are all right again, but, you know, it does hint at a few issues behind the scenes. And you know, I heard Jacob talking about this on the pod, that Thomas Tuchel in the last couple of weeks has suddenly switched from being everybody's favourite manager to, you know, being quite tetchy. Things are going wrong for Chelsea. And, it's quite interesting to see how that's all going to play out in the next few weeks with, obviously, Lukaku. If he does carry on scoring, then it's going to be all good for them, I imagine. But they're not really creating that many chances, and they're looking very dodgy at the back. They've got lots of issues with the team at the moment, but also longer term, you know, lots of players out of contract, lots of uncertainty now compared to, you know, when he first came in a year ago almost. Everything was just so plain sailing. So, yeah, quite an interesting dynamic going on at Chelsea at the moment.
Nedim, do you look at that interview and think, you know, we're constantly asking for footballers to be honest and tell us what they really feel, and there is someone saying, look, he's changed it. I'm not as happy about it, but I'm going to work hard. Or do you look at it as somebody who is either being badly advised or just don't say anything? It's better not to say anything.
Do you not find it weird that something that happened 3 weeks ago only comes out now in this sort of age where, you know, you could drop a tweet and that's the news for the day? Like, how could something be held off for 3 weeks?
It's a good question.
There's some red flags for me straight off the bat. I think players being honest can be a good thing. I think this one here, there's probably more to it. And I'll be interested to see what Lukaku says about this interview in the coming days and weeks to be able to sort of push back against it, whether he actually wants to, or whether he'll double down. But it is interesting that they can do this. And it's at a time where Chelsea are struggling. So that's why it feels almost like it was a targeted moment, because it could have been done 3 weeks ago when he wasn't in the side. But instead,
so who's targeting?
I don't know. This is the problem. This is all part of the, you know, we're all into like investigations and stuff. We could all figure this out together on the internet.
It's not the X-Files.
No. It's probably not. No, but it's I think players being honest is one thing. And for him, he clearly, if he said all that stuff and in the moment it made sense and he's going to double down and say this is how I felt in that moment, then fair play to him for being completely honest, because he shouldn't necessarily have to just make something up all of the time. I think it could maybe cause some level of discontent, but he's showing to himself that that's still the situation, because there are two sides to it. He said the negative things, but he said, I'm a professional. And he is, you know, players who aren't at that time, I don't think he was playing, players who aren't playing, if they say they're happy, they're lying. Whether you're sitting on the bench or whether you're in the stands or whether you're not playing week in, week out, you are unhappy. And to basically say that you have to say nothing now because you're unhappy, I know it's like kind of goes against the club's ideals of what media should sound like, but at the end of the day, that's the reality of the situation. And for Lukaku, he's not said that he's going to leave or anything like that. And he's come back in, he starts scoring goals and he's playing well. So it'd be something which I'd like to just have just like brushed to the side. But because they're now 8 points behind City, it's very much being put right in our faces, and as a consequence we won't be able to get past it until he comes out and says something.
We'll see what happens, I guess. Manchester City fullback Joao Cancelo says he suffered cuts to the face after attempting to fight off a gang of robbers while with his family. He posted an image of his injuries on Instagram. Unfortunately today I was assaulted by 4 cowards who hurt me and tried to hurt my family. When you show resistance, this is what happens. They managed to take all my jewellery, leave me with my face with this state, got cuts and bruises on his face. After so many obstacles in my life, this is just one more that I'll overcome. On the BBC, I had no idea about this, but he was a passenger in a car accident that killed his mum when he was 18, which is obviously an incredibly tragic story. Manchester City said in a statement they were shocked and appalled. The club said Joao and his family are being supported by the club, and he's helping the police with their inquiries as they investigate this very serious matter. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll start with the EFL. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. The EFL, Ben, before we talk about sort of what's going on the pitch, they've decided to scrap game day COVID-19 testing in a bid to stop last-minute postponements of games, which seems likely that there'll be fewer postponements, but more likely like lots of players will just run around with COVID.
Yeah, I mean, it's logical in the sense of that whole Blackburn game, Boxing Day, you know, I think it was called off a couple of hours before kickoff. Hull came out and sort of defended their lateness, really, and the timing of things. But it was unacceptable. I think it was almost 3,000 Blackburn fans going up to Hull. Called off, obviously, basically last minute in the grand scheme of things. And, yeah, that's obviously been removed to avoid repeats of that. Like you say, it does seem a bit weird in terms of the health and safety. But since the EFL have gone to these red protocols, obviously lots more testing and lots more positive results as a result of that. But I think this is probably kind of a happy medium. I think it's better. I do think it's better. I don't know about the finer details in terms of how safe it is. But I think in terms of the sort of logistics, if you like, I think it makes more sense.
Yeah, I think it's pretty risky, but they have to have some sort of cut-off time. And, you know, plainly 2 hours before kickoff when you're travelling across the country is not satisfactory. Yeah, I mean, perhaps 11 o'clock would be a bit fairer, even though that's going to inconvenience some people as well. But yeah, it's really, we feel like we're sort of living day to day at the moment, don't we? Every, you know, throughout the country, you know, just seeing what games can take place every day and just trying to keep going in the hope that sort of, you know, we don't have to stop because everybody remembers how, you know, how bad it was. And I think that the clubs are all very fearful about when we would play, well, when we're going to play all these games we've got to play anyway. So it's really difficult, but let's just hope that we can, you know, that they can keep as many games on as possible in the next few weeks.
I think to be a footballer is a brilliant job. It has its pluses, it has its minuses and all that stuff. And if somebody says you got to go and get tested at 6 a.m, just go and get tested at 6 a.m, just deal with it. Because if you want to play the game, that's something that which you'll do. And I imagine them testing at 6 a.m. isn't going to disrupt the game any more so than having to play a game on the 26th and 28th from a late kickoff or an early kickoff or whatever. Like, just, I don't know, just suck it up. Just deal with it. Then everyone from some point, like, it's more than just the players who the games are being called off for. Like, there's so many stakeholders within the game of football. Think about them as well. The game is the game, but the fans are the fans. The other people who work in there, whether it's, you know, serving drinks or whatever, or doing security, just do it early. Like, the benefit is huge. I know you'll be awake 20 minutes, half an hour early. I'm sorry, but just do it. Just do it.
What about the vaccination rate in the EFL, Ben? Like, it's sort of around 75%. It surprised me because Football League players, you know, aren't all multimillionaires, right? You know, this has a real impact on them, and they, you know, a lot of them live, you know, year to year contracts. You know, another year makes a big difference to them in terms of, you know, the rest of their lives, because they can't just retire at 35 or whenever and just go on. They have to possibly do something completely different. So I was surprised that the vaccination rates were lower actually in the Football League.
Yeah, it was surprising. I think from clubs privately, and you've got to remember, a lot of these club doctors, you know, are GPs sort of in their other life, if you like, and in their spare time. And they, I think there's an air of annoyance really in some parts about this. Yeah, 1 in 4 as of November, the EFL released the figures, didn't they? Detailing 1 in 4 had no intention of being vaccinated, which, yeah, is not ideal. And I don't know the way around it. Obviously, everybody, and I agree, I think it should be a choice. I don't think it should be beyond that. But I think it's creating a problem for clubs. I think some clubs have better relationships with players or sort of coaching staff have had a bigger role to play in terms of talking to their players, educating their players. I know of some clubs where they've had a sort of a mobile unit sort of turn up to the training ground, and they say that's worked really successfully because it's, you know, been on a plate for players. I know maybe Joe Public could argue, you know, players don't need everything on a plate like that, but it, you know, in that sense it's worked, and I'm all for that really, if it helps drive that vaccination rate. Personally, I find it disappointing, and I think if you're a club, there's an air of annoyance. You know, if you're a manager and you've got, I don't know, let's say a quarter of your squad, you know, because you know which players are vaccinated and not. I think that's really frustrating. I think it's a problem. I think create friction.
To jump in here, so we gave the stats and they're like mostly true, but here's the thing. So when that report came out, I think it said 59% of people had been double vaccinated. So it wasn't even the full 75. And of that 75 involved people who'd had a single jab or intended to be vaccinated. So the numbers are actually a bit lower. And
for, well, lower.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, like, I've spoken to some people who have no intention and so on, and they give their reasons for it. And, you know, it is what it is. But one thing which I think is objectively true is that the protocols that go on are shared by everybody. So one of my friends at this moment, he hasn't been vaccinated, and he had to miss 10 days because under the protocol, that's just what it is. If you are a close contact with somebody else, doesn't matter whether you've had it or whether you have it or you don't. So in theory for him, through this next period, if he continues to be a close contact with people, and this is people like in his family, people at the training ground, he could miss multiple weeks worth of football and still be healthy. So for me, the bigger thing here for some of these players in the Football League especially is that if recruitment's now going to take in vaccination status as being a factor, then when it comes down to the summer, where there's so much player turnover throughout those leagues, they might pick one player over the other because of the fact that if, you know, something was to happen and they were close contact, they'd still be available for them. Because the more chance you are of being unavailable for a football club, surely the less desirable that you are. So it's a very interesting position to be in. And also to mention one thing about that mobile hook coming over and whatever. I'll be honest, I didn't even know my NHS number until I retired and had to go and try and figure out what it was. Because when I was playing, it was always private healthcare. So I had no idea. So if it came down to putting this detail to go and do that, I didn't know where to even begin. So as a consequence, yeah, you're kind of built for one thing, unfortunately. So that's why sometimes you get spoon-fed, because for some reason you just don't know how to do it yourself.
Let's get into what's actually happening, Ben. So Bournemouth beat 10-man Cardiff 3-0 last night, go 4 points clear. 19 goals so far for Dominic Solanke this season. So very much in the Cameron Jerome envelope, can do it in the Championship, struggles with the jump. Maybe he'll do it this time. Fulham are, what, level on points with Blackburn, aren't they? Blackburn are absolutely flying at the moment.
Yeah, Blackburn going really well, all on the back of a 7-0 hammering against Fulham. They were down to 10 men, but since then they've been on this amazing run. I think they've won 6 on the bounce now. Top of the form table, and you know, really the team on paper, you would argue, is, and the squad, I think even Tony Mowbray might have alluded to this himself, is probably a little bit weaker than last season, but actually they're getting a lot more out of the team. Some players have emerged, young players have emerged, Lewis Travis in midfield, John Buckley as well, another homegrown player. And they've only obviously sold Adam Armstrong. I think it was 28 goals he got last season. Only Ivan Toney scored more than him. You're thinking, oh, God. You know, I thought it could be quite a bleak season for them. But obviously, they're going really well. They only reinvested 400,000 of the 15 million they got for Armstrong on a left-back from League One, Teo Edun. And, but things are looking really good. And it's so tight up there that they do have a chance. You know, even automatics are well within reach at the moment. I suppose everybody inevitably would expect them to kind of fall away, given Fulham, Bournemouth, that resources are probably stronger. And it'd be interesting what January holds as well, because they've got a core of players, Ryan Iambi, Joe Rothwell, and the captain, Daryl Lenihan, who are out of contract in the summer. And obviously, if teams try and test their sort of resolve, I suppose, a bit on those guys and try and pick them up on the cheap, that could be a problem. And then obviously you've got Ben Brereton Diaz, who since adding his mother's maiden name to his shirt has just been absolutely, phenomenal. That is one of the stories of the year season, clearly, and what he's done with Chile as well. Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to see what the second half has in store for them. I don't know if I do fancy them to trouble the top two, but they've got a hell of a chance.
Ben Brereton Diaz's story is so good, isn't it? Like, just when he scores for Chile, and he's all, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like he scores every time he plays for Chile. And just these sort of wild scenes in Santiago, wherever they happen to be playing that game. It's just an utterly brilliant story.
Yeah, face of Pepsi now, I think, over there, which, you know, is the ultimate amazing sort of compliment, isn't it? And it's amazing how it started. I'm chatting to Blackburn a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, it all kind of stemmed from this A to Z program feature, which they sort of said, I think it was the unknown, the U part of that feature. They said, you know, tell us something about yourself that we might not know. And he sort of said, oh, I'm half Chilean. And from there, it snowballed into Football Manager picking that up, recognising his nationality and therefore legibility. And then it snowballed into, you know, ultimately, obviously, playing for Chile at Copa America and just absolutely ripping it up now for Blackburn and club and country. And I think there's a little bit of worry, I suppose, that a club could come in for him in January, you know, big money. And I think Blackburn and Venky's would sell in that case if the money was right. But also, I think everybody's so kind of pleased and elated for him as a story. You know, this guy from Stoke who had quite a tough time. You know, Blackburn paid, I think, £7 million for him from Forest when he was about 21, 22. Didn't really happen, you know, until a few months ago, really, when it's really taken off and he's had that kind of lift-off period. And it's a great story, absolutely brilliant story.
You mentioned Forest there. They've had this incredible resurgence under Steve Cooper, while Middlesbrough having this sort of same thing under Chris Wilder.
Yeah, Borough sort of second to only Blackburn, really, in terms of that form table. Chris Wilder did an amazing job. He actually goes back to Bramall Lane on Saturday, obviously where he, you know, did remarkable stuff at Sheffield United, who themselves are going really well under Paul Heckingbottom. But yeah, Wilder's gone in at Borough, that sort of familiar 3-5-2, with Adam Neil, his sort of trusty right-hand man, who has implemented a bit of that actually with Wales, and kind of the emphasis on the wing-backs getting really high. And again, Borough look a little bit light in terms of the squad, but Wilder's getting every kind of drop out of them, and I think they've got a couple of interesting loans lined up. Aaron Connolly looks set to join from Brighton, which I think would be a very smart pickup in the Championship. And Borough going well. Forest have lost, I think, the last two. But Steve Cooper's sort of overseen a hell of a turnaround, really. And again, they're in the conversation for the playoffs.
Alan Neil, of course, most famous for falling off his bike when he hit a squirrel. And I think, I can't remember, but some fans were told not to dress as squirrels. I can't remember who was playing, Talking Scunthorpe or something. Don't dress as squirrels when Alan Neil is in attendance. At Derby County, they've won three in a row. How far behind are they? What, 11 points?
11 points, but Reading do have a couple of games in hand.
Right. Could they?
I know. I'll be honest, I had to do a piece, Championship at halfway, so what, for Christmas, and I said, oh, you know, any chance of survival is vanished, and, you know, maybe I'm going to look stupid. I still think it looks nigh on impossible. I mean, it's easy to get carried away. They've obviously won three on the bounce, and you think, God, this is brilliant. I don't know. It does still feel impossible from my point of view, but I think Rooney is doing a hell of a job. But just to motivate the players, I know he said before about showing them an alternative league table, so he sort of shows them the table without the points deduction, so that it's not so, I don't know, dreary, I suppose, in the dressing room. They would be comfortably mid-table, I think, if it were not for the points deduction. I think the killer thing, really, the horrible thing for them, is that extra 9 points that they got on top of the administration is the ones that are, you know, are making this seem impossible still, to be honest. But yeah, Rooney's doing a hell of a job. Still, the club is in a worrying situation. The administrators say they're hopeful of completing a sale in January, but we've heard that for a little while now. It doesn't seem to be getting any closer. Still dozens of creditors are owed. Fans stumped up, I think, just over £8,000 to pay off the St John Ambulance, which, you know, is pretty nice touch from them. And I think they're obviously still very much worried about their club. But Rooney on the pitch, keeping everything in good shape.
Was when you see the way Norwich have been in the Premier League for the last two times they've been there, and you see what happened to Fulham the last time they were there, I see those two teams as being teams in the Championship who play like total football. It's like, it's gorgeous to see all that stuff. You know, they dominate, it feels like. But then they take that to the Premier League and they really struggle. And as they go up, almost feels to me like some of the other teams have other characteristics, which mean that they'll maybe be more competitive at that top level. So when you sort of think about that, firstly, I don't know if that is true, but say this group of clubs that are in the Championship right now who could potentially go, who would you say are probably best suited to the Premier League should they get the opportunity to do so?
It's a weird one. Great question. I think it's a weird one as well, given that my answer, I would I feel like it could be unpopular saying this, but I'm tempted to say West Brom, who, you know, are struggling at the moment. They dropped to fourth. Valerian Ishmael, there's sort of a minority of fans there who are not quite having him, for want of a better phrase. But he plays this kind of underdog football, which serves so well at Barnsley. Mm. And I think the problem West Brom have is that they're playing teams that they're expected to beat, especially at the Hawthorns. You know, teams come there and make life difficult. But I think if you were to get in the Premier League, having this chat a couple of weeks ago, if you were to get in the Premier League, I think they would cause problems with that style. Whereas, as you say, those like Bournemouth want to play the right way with Scott Parker. Obviously, we saw it at Fulham. You know, it was a decent team, really. I'm not saying it was a well-beating team. There's some good players and, you know, they went down. Fulham probably are put into that same bracket. And I would argue maybe West Brom are the best. I mean, Blackburn, I suppose, a bit unknown in that.
So is that the idea that you would almost have to sell a lot of players that have got you up or just change what you do? Because playing with the ball the whole time is just a completely different thing than not having the ball the whole time.
Perhaps. But one thing I would say, there's certain teams in the past who've had the ball, but then they've still got a certain level of steel about them. Whereas I think when I looked at, so I've been doing punditry, whatever, for a year, and there's one take which I'm quite proud about. So it was back in February, March time, and Newcastle was sinking.
Just one.
So I've been of value. Right. So Newcastle were kind of sinking like a stone, and Fulham, they'd drawn like four games in a row. And people were like falling in love with Fulham again because they say, oh, the style of football they play, it's so nice, this, that, and the other. And I got asked the question right at the end of the show. I said, who do you think is going to stay up? And I said, I think Newcastle. And it seemed people like looking at me like I was crazy. But I said, I think Newcastle because I think they can win without playing the best football and looking nice. Whereas for Fulham, I feel like for them to win, they have to play really well and then everything comes together. And being in the Premier League, if you come up from the Championship, it's inevitable that you won't have the best players in the Premier League. You won't have the best style of football in the Premier League. So you need to have something else. And whether that's a case of, you know, being solid and hitting teams on the break or just being incredibly competitive, because you're not going to outplay anyone. Because whoever's playing in there, they didn't arrive there by accident. Those teams haven't arrived there by accident. So the game's going to be of a different sort of standard. So, I took that take and it ended up working out quite well. Because Fulham were playing okay, but then they were getting draws. And like as I say, in terms of the same thing that's happening with Norwich now, you can dominate in the Championship because it feels at times they have the best strategy, they have the best players, they can control matches, get to score 100 goals, great. In the Championship, if you're a really good side, you're the favourite for most games. When you come to the Premiership, everyone fancies beating you, every single team. So those teams where you're going to play, say Norwich will play against Burnley and think like this is a winnable game for them. That's the equivalent in some ways of like being in third in the Championship and playing against first, but they don't perceive Burnley as being that team who are that good, even though that's essentially what they are. Every game in the Premier League is a big game where you are evenly matched at best and overmatched at worst. So I think there's a, as I say, it's interesting. Like, it doesn't surprise me that Brentford are doing better than Norwich because they've got something that's a bit different, even though Norwich just took the mick out of the Championship for yet another year, if you get where I'm coming from.
Ed, were you going to come in or not?
Yeah, just my experience as a Palace fan and you know, as a journalist, seeing them get promoted, you know, back in the day, 2013. They'd never stayed in the Premier League before, came up through the playoffs. And Nedham's right, they didn't play the best football, but they adapted and they played to their strengths, which was obviously at the time Zaha, Bolasie, you know, doing their thing, quite direct style of football. And Ian Holloway got sacked, they brought in Tony Pulis, and he found the sort of the formula that was enough to keep them up. And that's what you need to do when you're promoted. The first aim is, it's a cliche, but you know, 40 points or more like 36 points or something like that these days. And if you can get there, whatever way you can find to get there, you don't have to play good football. And so I think I'd agree with Ben, you know, somebody like Ishmael, if he could get West Brom playing the way that he wants them to, they'd be a real handful for the Premier League, because Premier League sides aren't used to playing against such a physical approach. It would, you know, they'd have to change up what they normally do. There's something to be said for that, and I think trying to compete with the big boys, you know, playing lovely football is never gonna work out well.
I was going to say, just carry on from what Needham said as well, because with Brentford, they've got that long throw, haven't they? And obviously Tony brings that kind of big presence up top, and I think that if you put those two things together, that's how you can, you know, you can offer something different and kind of a bit ugly and horrible to play against. And you know, they've really used that to their advantage this season. That's how I can see West Brom, and like you said, I see that as a sort of deficiency in those Norwiches and other teams. I mean, in the short term, West Brom, do have problems. I think, what have I got here? It's called 5 goals in 10 games, 2 wins in 8. So it's, you know, it's not a great run, but they are in the mix. They are, you know, they're fourth. So, you know, Fulham, yeah, for example, in that time have scored 22. So
I like the idea that it is just a long throw, and then that's what you need. It's just like you've got your silky championship squad, and you get Andy Legg or Dave Chandler, and then you're absolutely fine.
It's just to give yourself a chance. You know, there's no guarantee that you'll stay up. But say start of the season, Norwich want to play the nice football, and they go to the Etihad, and they lose like 6 or something because they're trying to outplay Man City. Like, moving the ball is fair enough, but if it doesn't lead to anything, then it's worthless. And I'd rather, from when I was playing, any team that was coming up from the Championship, you always were more concerned about the games whereby you'd be running more channels, having more of a physical threat, as opposed to the teams you want to try and outplay you. Because for them, like, the playing, it literally means nothing if you can't create opportunities and score goals. It just looks nice. But at the end of the day, like, you could end up like Fulham did last year and you get basically nothing for it.
All right, that'll do for part 2. Part 3, we'll have 10 minutes of idle transfer gossip. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. Transfer window, I imagine it as a bay window, and one that is quite old and quite stuck, and you have to sort of push it quite a lot. And then when it goes, it might actually take your chin with you as it goes. I don't know if anyone else imagines the window in any sense. But Ed, perhaps more importantly, you've written a piece about potential big moves in January. What's going to happen?
Well, I'm a little bit dubious whether there will be that many, to be honest. I don't want to start on a negative, but I think, yeah, I mean, there's certain clubs. Obviously, we talked a bit about Newcastle. They're going to be desperate to bring in players. But I think that just the situation with COVID, especially at the moment, means that there's going to be a lot of fringe players who would be desperate to get out, and probably still are desperate to get out and find themselves new clubs on loan or permanently. But I think a lot of the clubs are going to be quite loath to let them leave in January, just because of the issues we've got at the moment, you know, with COVID and so many players being missing. But that's not to say that, yeah, that there won't be any moves, because there will be, and there's lots of speculation swirling around at the moment, especially about Brereton Diaz, as we were talking about earlier. I think quite a few different clubs looking at him. And Tony Mowbray said the other day that it would take about 30 million to get him out of Blackburn. And he wouldn't begrudge him if somebody offered him 100 grand a week to move. So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting few weeks, especially as we mentioned at Newcastle, who look like they're going to get Kieran Trippier and quite a few other players as well. Sven Botman, I think, from Lille, the central defender, has been linked. And Tarkowski, as you mentioned, from Burnley, Ben. But yeah, I think Newcastle especially, we need to keep a strong eye on them. Probably another striker as well, Callum Wilson being injured for a couple of months.
I mean, I love a deathly quiet transfer, especially deadline day. Just seeing all those poor folk having to fill. I remember doing 3 hours on TalkSport, and the only thing that happened was Graham Dorans went somewhere on loan. I'm sure I've repeated it. It's like, no, we just said, no, this is all we've got to talk about is Graham Dorans. If we can do 3 hours on Graham, then we've succeeded. We did a reasonable. I've forgotten it all, but we learned quite a lot about Graham Dorans.
I used to love Graham Dorans.
Did you?
He was a good player.
I always wanted him to join Bristol City, but
did you?
Never did.
It never happened, Ben. Mm-hmm. Keep your eyes out in January. You never know. Where is he? Where's Graham Dorans now? He's probably in the A-League, isn't he? He's probably around the corner. Should find out. Jashek says, any comment from Ben Fisher regarding the incident that led to Broad Street Mall parking in Reading being shut? I've parked there and it's pretty tight, but I'd like an expert opinion. A Reading Town Centre car park set to remain closed over Christmas Day and Boxing Day following an accident. The incident took place on the entrance ramp of Broad Street Mall car park on Christmas Eve. The vehicle involved is unlikely to be recovered until Monday, the 27th of December. May have been moved by now, with the car park remaining shut in the meantime. Ben, your thoughts?
First thoughts are, I don't feel like I would go anywhere near Reading Town Centre. Feels like a bit of a no-go.
Right, oh really?
Parking, yeah, I feel like the parking situation would already deter me a bit.
Yeah.
So I can understand the carnage that's ensued.
Tom says, what was the most interesting thing that happened to Ben in 2021?
I mastered contact lenses. Does that count? Which was a big thing for me. That was a big moment. Not got them on now, which is a shame. But the listeners don't know that. So
And what was the struggle? The struggle sounded real.
The struggle before was just very intense frustration. But the feeling of satisfaction doing it, it was just like no other feeling.
And what were you not getting right?
Just the poise, the sort of composure, the final descent into the iris. But now I'm a changed man. It's been a game changer, and it means I can actually play 11-a-side football. So, here's to 2022.
So that means, were you playing 5-a-side sort of like Ed Moses or Huey Teep with the
I'd contemplated the Edgar Davids so much so that I had a little leaflet from the opticians about all the different coloured options for the glasses. And then at football, at 8-a-side or whatever, I was just wearing glasses. And if it was raining, I needed like little windscreen wipers or something because I was a bit out of action. I mean, I would like to say it affected my game, but I don't know if that was just excuses.
Oh, well, good for you, mate. Well done.
Thank you.
Finally, we've gone on a bit too long. MM says, what are the panel's footballing New Year's resolutions for 2022? Nedim, you put yours in the group. I thought it was interesting. If it was for broadcast.
Yeah, so for me, I play the game a long time. I think I can get a steer on how a game's going. So I'm going to have to put more games on mute just because some of the stuff which I hear is firstly is wild. And secondly, I feel like I can just enjoy a game and just take it all in without having the emotion. But sometimes when the audio is on, emotion gets drawn in. And as a consequence, I feel like I then start missing things. So I'm just going to be watching a game, maybe listening to some music, maybe listening to this podcast, who knows. But then, as I say, the football itself is more important than the way that other people narrate it sometimes. And not everyone, but some people.
Any New Year's resolutions, Ed, Ben, or should we just all go and have our New Year's Eve parties, whatever they happen to be?
Well, I want my team that I coach to win their first league game of the season, having had a difficult...
What are the team called?
Athenley.
Athenley. Come on, Athenley, under-15s.
It's where Ben Watson began his career and Anton Ferdinand.
Okay, well, good luck. Thanks so much, everyone. Thanks, Ben. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Cheers, Ed.
Cheers, Max.
Cheers, Nedim.
Thank you, sir.
We'll be back in the new year, pretty soon, I presume. Monday is my guess. But have a lovely New Year's Eve, whatever you do.
This is The Guardian.